The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org. I trust that many of you saw Robert Stone's cover essay in the New York Times Book Review this past weekend. It was not only a rave review of Dexter Filkin's new book, The Forever War, but a meditation on the changing role of war correspondents since the 1960s. Stone writes, "These journalists often saw themselves as serving a higher truth than patriotism, but also as performing a greater service to the public and the country than any number of generals." He continues, "With the publication of Dexter Filkin's stunning book, The Forever War, it seems the journals of the brave correspondents assigned to the Middle East will take their place as the preeminent record of America's late imperial adventures. The heart of these heartless exercises in disaster maybe some consolation to those maimed and bereaved in them. His writing is one of the scant good things to come out of the war." Stone's review could describe as well Farnaz Fasihi's powerful new book, Waiting for an Ordinary Day, The Unraveling of Life in Iraq. Fasihi, senior Middle East correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, offers intimate portraits of ordinary Iraqis combined with a forthright account of what it was like to be a reporter covering the war. In a 2004 personal email, which she sent to friends that was widely circulated, went viral, she wrote, "The genie of terrorism, chaos, and mayhem has been unleashed onto this country as a result of American mistakes, and it can't be put back into a bottle." Her book leaves us with a devastating sense of the fallout that the American invasion and occupation have had on civilians' daily lives. Farnaz Fasihi is now based in Beirut, Lebanon. She joined the journal in January 2003 and was immediately sent to Iraq. She has studied. She has degrees in English from Tehran University and in journalism from Columbia University. Dexter Filkins, foreign correspondent for the New York Times, has worked in Afghanistan and Pakistan and from 2003 to 2006 in Iraq. He's been a Pulitzer Prize finalist, has received a George Polk Award and two Overseas Press Club Awards. And in 2007-2008, he was a fellow at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government. Tonight, these two acclaimed war correspondents discuss truth on the ground in a time of war. They discuss their experiences covering the war in Iraq, before they went to Iraq, how they inform the public, and they explore what a reporter must do to keep his or her own humanity intact in a time of danger and carnage. We were privileged to have LA Times combat photographer Rick Loomis give his account of his time in Iraq, as many overseas embeds over there a few months ago, and we are equally honored tonight to continue this discussion with Dexter Filkins and Farnaz Fasihi. Please give them a warm welcome. Thank you.
I'm going to start then. My name's Dexter Filkins, and this is Farnaz. And the name of my book is The Forever War. I thought I'd just tell you a little bit about my book and then kind of tell you a little bit about what I did, and then I guess you'll do the same, and then we'll talk a little bit. And if it gets boring at any point, you know, just do hand signals. You know, the name of my book is The Forever War, and I came into this very accidentally. I sort of came into this whole. The last decade of my life was started out very accidentally. I was sent to India for the Los Angeles Times, and thinking I was going to spend most of my time in India. And this was in the late 1990s. And I kind of found myself increasingly being drawn to Afghanistan and Pakistan. And it was a very strange time to be there. The opening chapter of my book is actually I'm sitting in the Kabul sports stadium on a Friday afternoon watching a public execution and amputation, very strange time, because of course it was just sort of these strange people with, you know, who looked kind of funny and were doing these really weird things, but they weren't really, it wasn't really connected to anything, you know. But anyway, and I kind of did all of that. I was expelled and arrested by the Taliban in 2000, and so I didn't get to go back until after 9/11 when the war started. And I was in New York for 9/11 and went back to the Afghan War in 2001, 2002. And then, you know, as the big show started in Iraq, I went over there and I spent almost 4 years. And then, you know, I left Iraq in late 2006, and then went to Harvard, and where I wrote this book. But I did go back a few times, and in fact, I was just in Iraq on Friday. I just got back; hadn't been there in a long time. It's very different now. We can talk about that too if you want. But anyway, and so my book, in a word, I didn't want to write a kind of blow by blow book. I think we have a lot of those. There's been a lot of great books on Iraq and Afghanistan, but I think most of them. Many of them are they kind of are written from 10,000 feet up. You know, it's sort of what happened to Washington and why and how. And I had spent so much time on the ground there that I wanted to do a book about kind of what it felt like. You know, the blood and the sand and the fear and the terror and the ambiguity and the confusion. And so I wanted to write kind of a visceral book and an emotional one rather than an intellectual one. So there you go. So why don't you rescue me, okay. Please?
Hi. How's the microphone? I'm Farnaz. My book is titled "Waiting for an Ordinary Day: The Unraveling of Life in Iraq." My connection to the Middle East is very personal. I'm Iranian American, born here to Iranian parents, and spent part of my childhood in Iran. I was 8 years old when the Iranian Revolution happened, and a year later, the war with Iraq. So Iraq entered my vocabulary when I was very young, and I remember the bombardments and the bunker drills in grade school. I started my journalism career in Iran as a stringer for the New York Times, actually, and then came to New York and went to graduate school at Columbia and sort of climbed up the chain of newspapers, local news reporting, and I was also at the foot of the towers when they collapsed on 9/11 and thought I was going to die, and, you know, the smoke just took over, and I'm sure you remember too. It was all the noise and all the chaos. When it was evident that we were going to go to war, I kept insisting to my editors to send me to Afghanistan because I spoke Farsi and I knew the region. And so I volunteered to be a war reporter, and they shipped me off with $5,000 and a sat phone.
Which lasted about a week.
Yeah, I know, exactly. It lasted like 5 days, and then they had to figure out hawala, like, you know, illegal transfers of money from New Jersey to Afghanistan. I stayed on for much of that first of 2001 in Afghanistan and Iran and the Middle East, and did a lot of reporting also in the Palestinian territories and Israel. So when the war in Iraq started, or we knew that the U.S. was going to invade the war, I wanted to be involved again. I thought it was going to be a really big story and a historical point in the Middle East. I got hired by the Wall Street Journal, and they sent me to Iraq, where I spent about 3.5 years. I left December 2005. When I left, things were really, really bad. It was the beginning of the civil war, and I know that it's improved some. But I wanted to write a book because I felt, as Dexter pointed out, a lot of books on Iraq have focused on the military aspect and the question of our troops and the policy surrounding the war, but very little really has been written about how the war impacted the lives of ordinary Iraqis and what it did to them. My book has two stories. It sort of tracks the lives of several Iraqis from 2002. I went to Iraq when Saddam was still in power, so I got to see it from Saddam to civil war. My own experience as a reporter, and as Dexter mentioned, what it was like to see experience war firsthand and see, you know, so many lives falling apart all around you, and also be a target ourselves. You know, I think that's one of the things about Iraq that was so unprecedented was the dangers we faced. You know, no?
Yeah. I should say that this is the first time that Farnaz has ever seen me with a jacket, and it's the first time I've ever seen her in a dress.
Yes. This is true. So, what should
we... You were going to talk about the start of the war.
I was going to talk about... Yeah, we were talking before, and I was telling Dexter that I remember when I got to Iraq, right to Baghdad, right after the fall of Saddam's regime, it was striking how freely we could roam around and talk to people, and Iraqis were just really eager to tell us what was going on and speak up their mind, and it was very different than when I was there in 2002, where, you know, if you mentioned Saddam's name, they would panic, and nobody wanted to talk to you, and they were afraid to tell you what they were thinking. So for a brief moment, I think there was this anticipation that things may actually get better, or Iraq may open up to the world and progress. Right? I mean, is that what, what was your experience?
Well, I had a slightly, you know, I probably have the same mindset that Dick Cheney did. I had been in Afghanistan.
That's disturbing. Next,
I'd been in Afghanistan in the war there, and it was an astonishing time. I mean, the towns fell, and you know, I was just with the Northern Alliance then. There weren't any Americans on the ground at the time. They were up in the air dropping bombs, but these towns were falling to the Taliban, and it all happened in about 72 hours. The whole thing just collapsed, and you know, after about 6 weeks of bombing. And it was just extraordinary. You know, we'd go into these towns, and people were like digging up TV sets that they'd buried in plastic bags, you know, 2 years before. They were throwing their turbans off. You know, it's kind of all cliches now, but it was really, really thrilling at the time. And it was like, you know, the good guys won, you know, and the Taliban's out of here. It was fantastic. And I was in Kuwait City when the war started, on the first day of the war. And I rented a car. I went to Hertz Rent-A-Car, and I rented a car. And I drove into Baghdad on the first day of the invasion, which is absolutely the dumbest thing I ever did. But I want to say that I returned the rental car in absolutely perfect condition. I drove it all the way to Baghdad.
Did you really?
I drove it all the way to Baghdad. And when I brought it back and brought it into the parking lot, somebody backed into it at the last moment. It was extraordinary. But God, really, I mean, I was dodging airstrikes the entire way, and it was just it was perfect. But I remember really well driving into Iraq the first day, and I drove into Safwan, which is a little town on the border, to Shiite town, and I was kind of waiting for the cheering crowds, you know, me and Dick Cheney, but I really was. I mean, I thought, well, you know, I've done this. It was only 18 months ago. I've seen this before, and I remember as we sort of drove in, they weren't cheering. You know, they were kind of all standing there, the whole village, kind of looking at us, kind of open mouthed, absolutely horrified. Totally kind of, some people were cheering, some people were crying, kind of open-mouthed, absolutely horrified. Oh my God, what is this? What's going to happen? You know, the American troop carriers are just kind of rolling by. And it was an extraordinary time. I mean, that particular day, I remember, you know, as soon as I got out of the car, I mean, as often happens when, if you're a Westerner in a place like this, you know, like an old woman walked up to me and threw her arms around me and started crying and laughing and crying and laughing, which was kind of like the whole day, laughing and crying. And she said to me, you know, they took my son away. They took my son away. Help me find my son. Help me find my son. And you know, the place was like, and I say this with the greatest sympathy, but it was as if we had broken into a mental institution. Here was this deeply, deeply traumatized country that suddenly was ours. And it was as if this kind of broken place was being... had been held together by this steel frame of this dictatorship for so many years. And we broke the frame, and it fell apart in our hands, you know. God, that single day was so extraordinary because it was kind of all there that day. And I even remember, and then I'll shut up. After I talked with the woman, whose name was Khosra, I think, for a while, another man came up to me. A kind of short guy, and he had a nice little shirt on, and he said, you have to save me, you have to save me. If you don't save me, as soon as the Americans leave, they're going to kill us all. And I said, well, what do you mean by that? You know, and he said, well, the secret police are going to come back. The Macabre's going to come, and they're going to take us all away. And I said, well, who's the Macabre? You know, and he pointed about 50 feet away, and he said, the Macabre, that's the head of the Macabre right there. And so, as you can do in a country like this, I said, well, let's go talk to him. So we walked over there. And I had, at this point, about 200 people behind me. And I said, so everybody here says you're the head of the secret police. And he said, Inshallah, you know, the Macabre will return. And he kind of laughed, and he walked away. And it was like, whoa, you know, there it was, you know, the whole war in a single day. But my experience was sort of, it was a hopeful period.
I think I meant more
troubled.
Like that, yeah. The first months after the invasion. If the day of, I was in Kirkuk the day after Baghdad fell on April 10th, which was the day Kirkuk fell, and my experience is very similar to yours, that they brought down the statue and there were the Kurds coming in, and it felt like you say, there's this prison gate or mental institution gate had been opened, and I had never seen anything like that. I'd reported wars and in Afghanistan and in Gaza and in the West Bank, and I'd never seen anything like that. They were torching hospitals, they were looting elementary schools, they were burning supermarkets, and it was just like these crazy people with this manic expression frozen on their faces running through the city, and it was just very, very bizarre. And this uncertainty, you know, and within 6 or 7 hours at noon, I think we got there around 11, and they were bringing down the statue around noon, and there was some shooting in the air and some celebrations. That by 3 o'clock, the city was burning. It was looting and mayhem. By 7 o'clock, all the people who were celebrating were barricaded in the houses, terrified to step out because they didn't know what was going on. And there were no signs of the American military. They weren't there. So there was nobody really to secure them, and I think what was really striking about the early days of this war was that the invasion went smoothly because we were a military superpower, but then there was no plan for the post-invasion, and they kind of made it up day by day as we went along, and don't you think?
Yeah, I remember, you know, I drove in the rented Ford Yukon. I drove into Baghdad on April 9th. The day the regime fell. And I remember, I mean, it was very similar to Kirkuk, but I spent the night in a palm grove outside of town, and I was kind of tagging along with these Marines. And they kind of weren't sure what was going to happen, and they said, maybe there's going to be a fight, you know. So I got up, and, you know, by 7 a.m., it was clear there was no Iraqi army. And I should say, the whole way up from Baghdad, as we drove up from Baghdad, you could just see the Iraqi military uniforms taken off and dropped in the road, just piles of them everywhere up. And, you know, by 10 a.m., everything was on fire. The Iraqis were tearing everything to pieces. And I remember thinking, I mean, it was like, really, it was like, I mean, to use a sports metaphor, it was like there was 2 minutes to go in the game and we were ahead by 40 to nothing. You know, this was like the conquering army, you know. I mean, they marched 300 miles in 19 days and they marched into the capital. And it was like, my God, we're going to lose the game. You know, we were ahead 40-0, and we're going to lose, you know. And I remember I had this one moment, and I'll shut up. I ended up that day, it was about noon, and I ended up in front of the office of the Iraqi Olympic Committee, which is kind of a joke, the Iraqi Olympic Committee. But that was this kind of personal fief of one of Saddam Hussein's more deranged sons, Uday. And the Iraqis were just, you know, I remember they were carrying stuff out. They didn't even know what it was, you know, like computer boards and stuff. And, you know, they're just kind of crazy. But this is a place where Uday had kept these really fabulous Arabian racehorses, you know, which must have cost $500,000 each. And they were taking them away and kind of leading them away. And it was like, what on earth are they going to do with this horse?
Didn't they loot the tiger too from the zoo? Or it was just
I remember this. So this was total chaos. And as I watched this, I was standing there watching it with a 24-year-old Marine lieutenant. You know, these guys are so young, you forget, they're just children. 24 years old, he was in charge of a platoon, so it was about 40 soldiers, and we were watching it together. And I said, so, what are you going to do, you know? And he said, I was terribly frustrated. He said, I don't have any orders, you know. And then he got kind of angry that I'd asked him that question, I think. And he did the most bizarre thing, really, to this day. He lined his men up, and this is this looting party. They're just tearing the thing to pieces. He lined his men up in a kind of horizontal line, and he said, forward march. And they marched with the rifles back and forth in front of the Olympic Committee office as if maybe it would scare everybody away. And of course, but by noon, the United States was already a paper tiger. I mean, it was. I mean, the Iraqis didn't even look up, you know, and so they just marched back and forth for you know, I don't know, endlessly. Yeah, it was like a play. I mean, it was really weird. So I think all the seeds were there, you know, that first day.
Yeah, no, it's remarkable when I went back to reread all my notes. I had a suitcase full of notebooks from my years in Iraq, and I remember talking to these two young men in Tikrit just the first days after Saddam fell. And Tikrit was Saddam's hometown. He had a very loyal base there. And it was the only city where his statue was still standing many, many weeks after the Americans had invaded. Nobody was bringing it down. And it was this weird thing where the Marines didn't want to go and bring it down because they were afraid that they would get attacked by the locals, and they didn't want to be seen, and they were kind of waiting for the Iraqis to bring it down. But there were signs popping up saying, Saddam is our great hero forever. And so it was a very bizarre environment. And, you know, the Marines got there, and the second day they got there, there was a car bomb attempt on the bridge leading into Saddam's palace complex. And this was just, you know, a few days after the invasion. So there was definitely, as you say, seeds of the insurgency. And I remember talking to one guy who was standing outside his home, and he said to me, and I have it in the book, that mark my words, this is going to be jihad, and it's going to be an intifada worse than you will see in Palestine, which I think is true. And that was April 2003.
So. Yeah, yeah. Which makes me think, I remember, and this was kind of in 04 and 05 now, but I actually did this when I was working on my book. I went back and I counted, I tried to count all the suicide bombings there had been, and this was kind of when my book was, when I was finishing it up. So as of March, there'd been 928 suicide bombings, and which is an astonishing thing when you think of most of the, or a lot, as far as they can tell, are from outside the country, the suicide bombers. When you think that 900 people, you know, have lined up so that they can kill themselves, and it's an astonishing thing. But just a kind of exponentially greater number of car bombs, you know, thousands, and so that I mean, Farnaz's office was car bombed
twice.
Fortunately, they never got that close to us. I mean, we had I'll come back to one, but the. Just, I mean, every morning, and for some reason, for reasons I could never really figure out, most of the car bombs would go off before, you know, by 10 a.m. Or by 9 a.m., they were all over. So, I mean, if you didn't have an alarm clock,
yes,
you know,
it's true. The boom.
Really, I mean, but it was remarkable. I mean, I think by late 2005, I was sleeping through them. You know, I mean, it was just, and so literally every morning there would be 10 or 15 bombs big enough and large enough to shake the house, you know, and it was always kind of a mystery. A bomb would go off and you'd think, is that really, really close or is it really, really big, you know, because mm-hmm. You never really, you know, you never really could tell. But, you know, Farnaz mentioned how strange this war has been because we've been targets ourselves. And, I mean, I think it was probably late 2005 when it became almost impossible for us to go to car bombs or suicide bombings right afterwards. Like if you went 30 seconds after one of them happened, as I've done.
The second one would come, right?
Yeah, well, the second one would come. Yeah, right. Yeah, you had to be careful of that. But the people would be basically out of their minds, as you can imagine, with grief and with anger. But, that, you know, it became clear that we were often being blamed. The United States was often being blamed for the car bombs. It was like this kind of collective psychosis that would just take over. And then I was attacked once in 2003 by a mob of, I don't know, 400 people. I don't know how we got away, but we did. But just to give you an example of the conditions that we had to work under, the New York Times, people asked me if we live in the Green Zone, and we never, we just rent a house in an Iraqi neighborhood, and it looks like basically a medieval fortress, you know. We have about 45 armed guards, we have belt-fed machine guns on the roof, you know, 20-foot-high blast walls, searchlights, razor wire, checkpoints. I mean, it's insane, you know, and we're just reporters, you know. And so that was kind of, and, you know, just, I mean, I'm just kind of speaking of our bureau, the people that we have a very, very big operation.
I think that's true for any media organization who has a bureau in Baghdad. It's extremely expensive, and that's why you only see the big three or four main dailies in the U.S., national papers having a bureau and the networks, because you know, every bureau is a fortress. You have to have your own little militia, your own guards, so you have to buy, train them, you know, make sure that they're loyal to you, that they have guns, they're aware of your security movements. So, you know, if you have a security problem or an employee problem, you can't really fire people that easily. So that's always very difficult, you know, because you think, you know, they could come back and kidnap me. And, you know, we can't do anything. We can't, we need to rely on the Iraqi staff to buy groceries, to cook our meals, to coordinate going in and out. And, you know, we have armored cars, we have to go out in convoys and make sure that we have guards with us. We, as mentioned, Dexter mentioned, the offices of the Wall Street Journal were bombed twice. We lost our office twice, once in a house in an ordinary, kind of an upscale neighborhood in Iraq. And I was in the house when it happened, and a car bomb targeted an American convoy that was passing by right outside our door. And the idea that this guy was sitting outside our door for hours in a car packed with explosives was really terrifying. And you know, the whole house shook, and I got flung across the room, and it was just a disaster. There were body parts, burnt body parts that were raining into our garden. It was a surreal experience. You know, we had to evacuate, and we then moved to the hotel in the Hamra Hotel, which is like a fortress of a cluster of media organizations that have all come together and built this fortress of blast walls and, you know, in security cameras and everything. And that was also bombed, a truck bomb, and our office got demolished. Luckily, I wasn't there. And so we did move into the green zone, because every time we would set up an office outside, it would get bombed, and it was just becoming very difficult and expensive, and security was a problem. So we now maintain our office in the green zone, but we also do, you know, go in and out and, you know, spend time outside as much as we can. But it's just the realities of working on the ground. You know, the violence is so random. It's any day, every day, every time you get out as a reporter, and every time Iraqis get out, it's like playing Russian roulette. You simply don't know if you're going to die on the way to work, if your kid's going to get blown up, if your husband's going to disappear, if what's going to happen. Every minute that you leave your house, or even when you're not leaving your house, even if you're sitting in your house, you could get blown up. So imagine what it's like to live with that trauma for 6 years and going, you know.
this is a somewhat lighter version of that, which I think it'll demonstrate how strange it is to work there, but also how strange it is for somebody who doesn't speak Arabic. And I only speak about 10 words of Arabic. And so we have to rely on our translators quite a bit, who are really fabulous people. I mean, the New York Times had two of our translators been killed. I've been in these just horrendous situations with them where I'll give you one example. I remember once there was some Sunni sheikh that I wanted to interview, and I know Sheikh Ahmed, say. And Sheikh Ahmed, you know, it was kind of unclear where he sort of stood on all this. He was very friendly with the Americans and kind of friendly with us, but we knew he was sort of doing some stuff that was kind of interesting. And so I took my good friend and interpreter Wazir Joff, who's kind of this kind of big. He looks like Clint Eastwood. He was a former guerrilla. He fought with the Peshmerga. He's a Kurdish guy, wonderful guy. And we went together, and we sat down with Sheikh Ahmed. Sheikh Ahmed was here, and instead of kind of sitting down right away, Joff and Sheikh Ahmed launched into this long conversation in Arabic. So I'm kind of sitting there, you know, doodling on my notebook. And the conversation became very heated, and it went on and on. And I kept saying, Joff, you know, I came here to talk to him about, you know, whatever the Constitution, whatever it was. And Joff said, you know, just hang on. And it got kind of heated again. And then it finally was over. He said, okay, ask your question. So I asked a question, you know, and everything was great. And Sheikh Ahmed, you know, he brought out the tea and the cookies and everything. And afterwards, we were driving back, and Joff was smoking a cigarette, and I said, Joff, you know, what were you guys talking about back there? And he said, well, he wanted to kidnap you. And, and you know, he said, you know, a million for a week, you'd make a lot of money off this guy. And million for me, million for you, you know. And Joff, fortunately, he's the Joff tribe is about the biggest tribe in Kurdistan. And he said, you know, he said, my tribe's way bigger than your tribe. So you'll leave my friend alone. And the sheikh was like, okay. It was just, you know, okay, sorry. It was just an idea.
I had the exact same thing happen to me. I wonder if it was the same sheikh.
Yeah. Sheikh Ahmed, you know, he's an enterprising. He's probably
no.
like the Minister of Defense now.
No, he was one of the Sunni clerics. And I went with my Iraqi translator, and I understand enough Arabic to realize what was going on. So, you know, we get in, and we're talking, and suddenly I make out that he's telling Haki, my translator, you know, I could make a lot of money off her. You know, isn't she afraid coming here? You know, at least I could get $500,000. Wall Street Journal's really rich. And I saw him kind of getting really nervous, and I'm like, what is he talking about?
Well, you know, in my book, I refer to these sort of the two conversations that go on in Iraq. And there's a kind of a conversation that was going on between the Iraqis and the Americans, principally between the Iraqis and American soldiers. And then the conversation the Iraqis were having with themselves, yeah. You know, which were completely different. And, I mean, just a quick story. I remember one day this was kind of late 2003 when everything was kind of starting to go to hell, you know. And I was sitting in a Humvee with this very nice lieutenant from South Carolina. His name was Christopher Roche, and he grew up on a poultry farm in South Carolina. He had this very, very heavy accent. And we were going down the Euphrates River, and he was kind of doling out money for dam repairs on the Euphrates, you know. And the Iraqis, kind of everywhere we went, you know, they were, you know, we love America, and they'd kind of take the money. I mean, you know, it was great. We're handing out these wads of cash. And it was working pretty well. I mean, the dams were getting fixed, and the Iraqis were kind of pretty happy. I mean, this was the Euphrates; it was on the Anbar province, the cradle of the insurgency. And so I was thinking as we were driving down the Euphrates, I was thinking, well, everybody seems really happy, but boy, you know, Anbar province is unbelievably violent. You know, so I waited for the lieutenant to walk up to his Humvee. And I turned to the Iraqis, one of whom was like the minister for dams, you know, in Anbar province. And I said, so what do you think of these guys? You know, and he said, we hate them. We want to kill them. We want to drive them out of our country. And he said, yeah, we take their money. Of course we take their money, you know, but they're the occupiers. And that was kind of, that happened all the time. I mean, that just happened all the time. Yeah. And if you didn't have a gun, you could actually, and yeah, I mean.
It happened all the time. I think one of the things, when the Americans declared Iraq an official occupation, they they sort of legitimized the insurgency in the eyes of the Iraqis. There were a lot of Sunnis who thought that attacking, or a lot of Iraqis, not just Sunnis and Shias too, that they thought that attacking Americans was okay because they were an occupying force. And although they didn't want the carnage and the suicide bomb, like intellectually they understood that this was contributing to their country being unstable, but there was just something inside them you know, made them kind of support it because of their pride or their nationalistic. And it didn't make any sense. You know, I remember having this conversation with the Iraqi staff, our Iraqi staff or our Iraqi friends, and I said, well, you know, this isn't leading to the country getting stable or getting better. But then they would say, yes, we know, but, you know, they're an occupying force. They're driving their tanks down our streets and they're raiding our homes. And then you would say, well, then, but if they're not here, then what about the car bombs and what about the insurgency and who's going to crush that? And you don't have a military, but it would just go over their head, you know.
I think, and not to jump too far ahead, but I just got back from Iraq on Friday night, and it's changed there. And I think the question that I ponder in my own mind is how much of it has it changed, or is it kind of how much of it is just on the surface? And I'll just a quick story, and then. The Sunni awakening is this kind of phenomenon that's kind of enabled, it's basically helped bring the violence down so much. I mean, the violence is down. I mean, it's remarkable when you go there. I mean, I don't even recognize the place now. It's truly remarkable how peaceful it is. I mean, compared to what it was in 2005, 2006. And one of the ways that they've done that is they've taken, basically, the Americans have taken 100,000 Sunni gunmen and put them on the payroll. So now they work for us.
$300 a month, I think, no?
$300 a month. So it's $30 million a month, which actually, when you think about sort of just unblown up Humvees and unkilled American soldiers. Basically, we're paying them not to kill people. And but, you know, it's kind of, I mean, in a way, it's sort of a measure. I mean, you could sort of laugh at that and say it's ridiculous and it can't possibly work. But in a way, you could also look at it and say, well, the Americans are sort of, you know, why didn't we do that 5 years ago? You know, money goes a long way in Iraq. And I'll just give you a quick image that was just totally bizarre. I was in Adamiya, which is a Sunni neighborhood in northern Baghdad. I'm sure you've been there many times. Which in 2006 was absolutely under the control of Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia. I mean, completely. Lock, stock, and barrel. And Americans didn't even go in there. And I was there at dusk, and I was standing. I had talked with these guys in the Awakening, and one of whom's last name was Al-Tukridi. He looked like a sort of recruiting poster for Saddam's army. And these guys were blowing up Humvees 18 months ago, and now they're making $300 a month from the American Treasury, and they're very proud. I mean, they said, "You know, we're keeping the peace here." You know, and as I walked out of their office, a wedding procession came down the street. It was a Thursday night. All the Iraqis get married on Thursday nights. And this procession came down the street. It was about 25 cars. And you've seen these weddings. Yes. They're fabulous. there's a black Mercedes in the lead car. And they saw me and they stopped, you know. Let's talk to the man who looks like a CIA agent. And so they stopped the car and the door swung open. And, you know, the groom gets out, kind of black tuxedo. He was very happy. And, you know, inside I could see the bride. She didn't get out, you know, sort of very sort of heavily made up face. But and he got out and he said, "Yes, it's wonderful. It's wonderful." You know, he said, "Look at the neighborhood. You know, look at the neighborhood." And then he pointed to the guys in the Awakening. And he said, "And it's all because of them, you know." So I don't know. You know, part of me thinks keep the money flowing, but
do you think it's long term? I mean, this is I wanted to ask you because you were just there. Whether you think it's long as long term solution, and B, how much of Baghdad's been segregated along sectarian lines? Because I remember from talking to people that a lot of the neighborhoods, one of the ways that they've kept the peace is there was a lot of population movement during the civil war in 2006. So So this Iraqi population movement created a natural segregation along sectarian lines. So you have Sunnis all living in one place, Shias, and the Americans have built walls around Adamiya. So they're, you know, so if that's how it is to take security, like you take a city and you build blast walls around them and set checkpoints and issue resident permits for people who live there, that's how extreme it is. I mean, that's what they've had to do. But I'm just not clear on whether that's a long-term solution or whether the Americans are kind of acting as a buffer zone for the Sunnis and Shias. What's going to happen when they leave?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's the can it work without the Americans around as the kind of referee? Yeah, yeah.
Did you see a lot of the neighborhoods kind of being walled off?
It's amazing. Yeah. In fact, I went to this same neighborhood, Adamiya. It's all Sunnis, once controlled by Al-Qaeda. And there was a couple of Shiite families that were moving back, which is was a very nice thing to see. There are only a couple, just a handful. But I sat with them, but right by their house was one of these 20-foot-long, 2-mile-long, 20-foot-high blast walls that sort of sealed it off from the next neighborhood over, because basically the ethnic cleansing was kind of going on everywhere. But you know, I think at one level, you know, a house of cards is better than no house at all. But it's you know, it's pretty tenuous. Yeah. Yeah. Another really quick story. I went, you know, the Mahdi army, I think, has been pretty substantially degraded.
Yeah.
Which is really remarkable. And so I went to the Sadr Bureau. You've probably been there. There's all the same Mahdi army military commanders are sitting around, except they don't have guns. And they were very, very sheepish, and they were kind of apologetic, and they were saying, "Well, you know, the Mahdi army got out of control, you know, we're really sorry." But these guys were these fearsome guys, you know. The last time I'd seen them, you know, this one particular commander, and I remember at the end of the interview, he said to me, "Do you think you could leave my name out of the story?" And I said, "How come?" And he said, "Because I'm a fugitive, you know, I'm wanted by the government." I thought, my God. But I went back that night, to listen to the call to prayer, and all the mosques in Sadr City are still controlled by Sadr's people, because they have a very sort of particular prayer.
As are, you know, all the seminaries in Najaf. All the seminaries in Najaf.
Yeah, so it's just very complicated.
So
yeah.
He has significant, you know, clout with the Shias, with the pop masses.
Yeah.
So, you know, it will stick as long as I guess he decides, or the different. That's the thing, you know. There are all these bit, you know, fractions contributing to the stability, but if you take anyone out of the equation,
yeah,
it could unravel again. Sure, we're just rambling on.
Uh-oh.
I'm going first?
Because I have no idea. Okay.
Okay, let me see what I have here.
Dear God. Maybe you could read two passages. I don't know. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm just...
I could tell another funny story while you're
okay. I thought it would be nice to just read a graph or two of the different times I was in Baghdad throughout the from 2002 and sort of give you a contrast of what it was like under Saddam and the war and after. So I'll start with October 2002 and Saddam still in power, and I have just arrived. Before I finally settle in my room on the second floor of the notorious Rashid Hotel, decidedly the most luxurious and modern establishment in the country, my roommate, journalist Vivian Walt, a more seasoned colleague who has been to Iraq before, warns me against getting too comfortable. The room is tapped, the phone line is tapped, they're listening to everything we say. There's a secret camera in the ceiling. You must change with the lights off and only in the bathroom. For the rest of my stay, Vivian and I develop a schoolgirl method of communicating, giggling and passing notes to each other while sitting 2 feet away. Often, we return to our room at the end of a day's report to discover our suitcases open, clothes rifled through, our notebooks misplaced. On that first night in Baghdad, I set out on my own for a stroll around the hotel. No one seems to notice me quietly walking out of the hotel lobby. The streets are well lit, and small groups of Iraqis are roaming around. So maybe I'll go to post-invasion. Sorry, I'm stumbling. There was a sense of eager anticipation for progress and improvement. Even when I stopped by Amal's house for afternoon coffee, I noticed that her bitterness is slowly decreasing as she busies herself with the task of refurbishing. Meanwhile, this is a friend of mine, sorry to insert, who owned an art gallery that was demolished after the war. Meanwhile, she's moved back to a small studio space upstairs near her study, where she can lock herself up from intruders who try to break in every now and then. She still hasn't found sufficient funds to restore her art center. She keeps a thick folder on her desk and asks me to review some of the proposal letters and project outlines she's prepared to submit to various aid agencies that focus on arts and culture. I must go on, one step at a time, if not for myself, for others who relied on the center for their livelihood, she tells me. And 2004. Security has become a full-time occupation. We now get full security reports emailed every day that detail the number, time, and place of various attacks. Coalition forces are being attacked approximately 80 times a day. Foreigners are nabbed left and right. I read through these reports as diligently as I read the headlines before I meet with the staff to map out a strategy for safe reporting. Instead of worrying about filing a great story, I fret about keeping everyone alive. The constant anxiety over death extends beyond the usual risks of war reportage. There's no telling what can happen to us anymore. And this is right before I left, at the end of 2005. Sometimes I find myself wanting to cry while I'm interviewing people, and other times I feel detached, like a machine recording misery and death. I have days when I open a Word document on my computer and stare at it for a long while without being able to write a story, until I've had a good cry. Other times I just crank out the sentences, burying myself in work on days that stretch 15 hours or more. I no longer see any of my Iraqi friends, because they're too fearful for me to visit them in their homes. Even on the phone, they speak quietly, and I sense an eagerness to hang up. Several times, Sabah Nasser, my Christian friend, whose family I've known since before the war, has abruptly hung up on me in the middle of the conversation because he heard footsteps in the street outside the window and doesn't want to be heard speaking English. Sometimes when I ring friends or Iraqi staff, they hear my voice and say in Arabic, "Galat numre," which means wrong number, and hang up on me because they're out in public, in a taxi or a shop, and don't want to be heard speaking to foreigner. So, that's my...
um, Well, I'm trying to think what to read here. There's so
Sorry
much.
Sorry if I took too long.
No. Okay, this is kind of a ha-ha story, but why not? Okay, well, I think it's pretty self-explanatory. This was in 2003 in Ramadi, and I'll just kind of take it off from there. In the morning, the captain and I had walked down a road lined with craters. We'd walked slowly, checking for wires, animal carcasses, loose dirt, bomb stuff. It was a sweltering morning in Ramadi, with the mist of the Euphrates infiltrating our lungs. Later on, sitting in a walkway of one of Saddam's old palaces, the captain started telling stories. We hadn't spent much time together, but we'd walked this road and survived, so the air around us was, for the moment, light and full of trust. We were both from Florida. So, the captain said, we came up with this great way to search villages. He pushed his knife into an MRE, that's a meal ready to eat. We got this girl here in the company, blonde. She's really hot, the captain said. This is when we were up in Mosul. We had to search all these villages for guns. Those villages are awful up there. So when we went into the villages, we put the blonde girl we had in the unit on top of one of the Bradleys. We just rolled in and put her up there on the Bradley and took off her helmet and let her hair spill out. So, the captain said, so she's standing there on top of the Bradley, blonde hair and everything, and we call out on the loudspeaker, this woman here is for sale. Blonde woman for sale. And I'll be damned if every Iraqi male in the village wasn't gathered around the Bradley in about 2 minutes. You know, the Iraqis are crazy for blondes, crazy for them. They don't have any here. The captain started eating his strawberry Pop-Tart. So, the captain said, she's standing up there in the Bradley, and we'd have us an auction. Highest bid gets the blonde. They're going crazy, the Iraqis, offering their goats, trucks, all their money, children, everything. I'm standing up there saying, nope, not enough, not enough. And they're bidding more money. One of the guys had his hands on the big machine gun just in case it got out of control. The Iraqis were wild. They were just staring at her. So, the captain said, so we're up there having the auction, and during the auction, I sent our guys around back into the houses to look for guns. We're having the auction. I couldn't name the captain. We're having the auction, and all the Iraqis are at the auction yelling for the blonde while our guys are collecting the guns from the houses. It was totally quiet in the houses, just the women in there. We got us a huge pile of guns, searched the whole village, no problem. So what happened with the auction, I told him. I asked him. Well, we shut it down. We just told them the bids weren't high enough. The captain laughed. The Iraqis were pissed off, but it was okay. I was laughing, and the captain got quiet for a second. We did that in 3 villages, worked every time. Then we got reprimanded. Somebody found out about it. They didn't like it, he said, chewing on his Pop-Tart. I thought it was brilliant myself. Smartest thing we ever did.
Question?
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. Go ahead. Hi.
I've been curious for the last 6 years about the lack, what it's like to live without electricity, water, and toilets working every day. And I just can't imagine it. Can you sort of describe it a little bit?
How graphic would you like us to?
It's one of the things that Iraqis complain about most, the fact that there's still, I think, 5 or 6 hours of electricity now. When I left, it was 2 hours in Baghdad, but I think now it's up to, 5?
Back down to 1.
One,
about an hour a day.
About an hour, yeah. And water is a big issue. There are a lot of people who are trying to dig up wells in their backyards or in their neighborhoods. And it poses all sorts of problems, in the summers particularly, because Baghdad's very hot. You know, you can't keep food in the refrigerator. It forces you to go to the market and have to buy vegetables and fruits and meats every day to plan your meals. And the markets get bombed all the time. So, you know, what do you do? Or you have no entertainment at night because... you know, you're all huddled. There's, you can't watch TV. You can't, you know, do anything. Everyone has a generator, but it's expensive to keep it. One of the problems it's also presented is for hospitals. You know, a lot of hospitals don't have enough electricity. And I remember one doctor telling me how, in the middle of an operation, once the electricity went off and they didn't have enough fuel, and the patient died under surgery. So that's sort of where things are.
Quick story. I was with, kind of different, in two summers ago, I was with a bunch of American Marines in Ramadi, which in 2006 in August, Ramadi looked like Dresden in 1945. I mean, it was completely leveled. And the only building that was still standing was this place called the Government Center, which was kind of a joke because there was no center and there was no government. But, and there were about 50 Marines in there hunkered down in this place, and it looked like this kind of, felt like this kind of French Foreign Legion post in the middle of the desert. And we got attacked. I was there for 2 weeks and we got attacked every day. And there was no water in this place, of course, and no electricity. And you couldn't literally step outside because there were snipers all over the place. And most of the gun battles took place on the roof. It was a three-story building. And so, for example, when you went to your Humvee, you had to run. And just from here to the wall, you had to run because the snipers were there. And so there were no bathrooms inside. I mean, because there was no water. And they couldn't put the portal outside. I think they had tried at one point in 2004, and the snipers had shot them up. So the Marines have invented this thing called the WAG bag. And I don't know if you're ever acquainted with the WAG bag, but WAG stands for Waste Alleviation Gel, and seriously, it's astonishing. But just a measure of what Ramadi was like in August of 2006, you had to go to the bathroom in the WAG bag, which is kind of a little green sack, and then you kind of pile all your WAG bags into a larger garbage bag, take it outside, and set it on fire. And throw it out the door. Going to the bathroom in Ramadi in 2006.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You want to take the next one? Go ahead.
Okay.
Okay, you pick.
How about you in the end? You have like a black dress on. Oh, anybody's fine. Fight it out.
Could you compare the time you spent in Afghanistan to the time in Iraq?
Yeah, I mean, we were both there.
Right.
You want to go first?
You go first.
Well, I mean, I did that briefly. I mean, I was there in the beginning of the war, but I think, you know, what can you say about Afghanistan? Is an extraordinary country. I mean, it's so beautiful. It's astonishing. It's like, you can go there, and it's like the fourth century. I mean, you can go into these villages that that don't even have the wheel yet. And they're so, I mean, there's no electricity. They've never had electricity. They've never had running water. It's absolutely extraordinary. But the most extraordinary thing for me about Afghanistan, and particularly if you go to a place like Kabul, I mean, I landed in Kabul for the first time in April of 1998. And it was, the city at that point had been at war for 19 years. The city was completely destroyed, completely destroyed. There were packs of orphans. I always remember the orphans. There were packs of orphans. They used to run at about, you know, in groups of as big as 100, and they would kind of descend on you, and they saw you. And it was this kind of ruined, absolutely destroyed society, which I think back then, back in the 90s, when I first met the Taliban, you know, the Taliban were popular. I mean, they you know, after the Soviet Union left Afghanistan in 1989, the country collapsed into this terrible, terrible chaos. And at one point in Kabul, for example, I remember somebody telling me there were 42 different militia checkpoints in Kabul itself. So just, you couldn't even drive across the city without paying bribes. And, you know, you had to worry about your daughters and your sons and everything else. And the Taliban came in and just, you know, they were the law and order boys, you know, and that's why they were so popular. So when I went to that execution in September of 1998, people understood. It's us or chaos, you know? And I think that's probably the biggest difference for me.
I think for me it was that the Afghans were really happy to have the Americans there, that particularly the women and the you know, the kids and the middle class educated society were. I often compare those first days after the Taliban fell to being in Sleeping Beauty when everybody wakes up. It was just this amazing awakening of and joy, and like, you know, women were not allowed to use public bathhouses under the Taliban, and so for 5 years they were forced to bathe at home, and many homes didn't have you know, hot water or a bath or a shower or a bathtub, so they had to boil water and, you know, kind of just give themselves a wash. So that, you know, right the first week, there were mile-long lines of women outside of the bathhouses. So there was this sense of freedom and joy, and that was really lacking in Iraq. In Iraq, it was more a sense of defeat and uncertainty. That was my experience.
I have one question.
Sure.
Were either of you in Baghdad during the bombing of Mutanabi Street? And if so, could you speak a little bit about what Mutanabi Street was, the street of booksellers, and what it represented and what that was about?
Well, the Arabs have a saying that the books in the Arab world kind of get written in Cairo and published in Lebanon and read in Iraq, which means the Iraqis were always a very educated, well-read, regarded as a very well-educated and well-read society, and it had this thriving book market where they would lay out all the books, you know, outside on the street, and you could find anything, you know, old volumes of poetry and, you know, Shakespeare and English literature, and it was amazing, and that was, it was located in the Rashid quarter of Baghdad, Rashid Street, which was the old neighborhood, and it also happened to be right directly across the palace complex of Saddam Hussein, which was targeted in the bombardment, and so it got destroyed partly, and also the looting and the burning also damaged it. Do you have any?
I don't remember that.
You don't remember it? Yeah.
I mean, there were so many.
Yeah.
Are we, oh boy, God. how about somebody over here? Okay, how about you? No, you got your hand up there, man.
Thank you. Dexter, I've seen you and guys like John Burns on Charlie Rose, and I saw Rick Loomis here not too long ago. And yet, I feel like I'm being played by the message that's managed by our government coming out of Iraq. And I'm wondering if you guys can give me a little bit of insight into what I'm not getting through that message that's managed by, for lack of a better term, our administration.
Well, I mean, I guess if there's... I mean, there's definitely a message coming out of Washington. I mean, that message has changed a lot. You're not getting a message from us. I mean, we're doing our best to, you know, deconstruct all that. Doing our best. I mean, I'm sure we don't get it right all the time. But, you know, let me just say, I think the remarkable thing for me, one of the remarkable things for me over the course of the years that I spent in Iraq, I remember in 2003, 2004, when, you know, anybody who was on the ground there, I mean, if you were on the ground in Iraq for 20 minutes, you could see that this thing was kind of deeply troubled, this gigantic project, and it was kind of coming apart, and things were spinning out of control. And we were writing these stories and basically saying that. And but the kind of the resistance that we got, you know, from, I should say, the administration and its supporters, some in Washington, some in Baghdad, was just extraordinary. I remember the unbelievably hateful emails I used to get, basically from the right wing, saying, you know, you hate America, you know, you're losing the war, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I have to say, I don't get those much anymore from those people. I do get them from the other side. I mean, I don't think anybody would argue anymore that, you know, that the Iraq War went well in 2003, 2004, so that argument's gone. But I think there isn't, I think the really... the really nasty emails I get these days are generally from the left that say, you're not telling us the whole story. You know, you're sitting in your hotel rooms. What about the village that got bombed? You know, what about the civilians they're killing? I don't know. I think that's a better measure of America than it is of Iraq. But what's your experience?
I can kind of allude to that email that was... read and say that when this private email that I wrote in 2004 about how things were falling apart and the war was basically a disaster, got into the public sphere by bloggers and forwarded emails. I was really under attack from both sides. You know, there were, as Dexter mentioned, the right wingers saying, you know, you're biased, you have an opinion, you're not objective, you shouldn't cover the war, and you know, we're winning there. And the left wingers accusing me of not telling the truth in my stories, or not, you know, this is the media censored. Why haven't we heard this? And I think both were very emotional reactions. They weren't really they weren't really true, because to the right wingers, you know, if you went back and printed all my stories and as my editors had, you wouldn't really trace any bias, and the stories were all objective. And to the left side, if they had read my stories closely, they would see that all the facts that I had mentioned in my email were reported in the pieces in the Wall Street Journal. But for some reason, we've I don't know if fail is the right word, but the media can't figure out a way to capture the imagination or grab the attention of the public about what's going on there. I think it's the violence and the numbers, it just piles up, and you know, it just, people just roll their eyes.
I mean, I think this war is so deeply polarizing.
Yeah, it's very polarizing.
So deep,
right.
And so basically everybody has made up their mind about it one way or another, and it's very, very difficult to just kind of tell people what you see, and if it doesn't kind of line up with what
right,
they want to hear, then
thinking.
You're going to get a nasty reaction. You know.
But I think, as Dexter mentioned, I do think that sort of even the administration's message has changed. I think the first year,
yeah.
which was an occupation, you know, the whole war was fueled by ideology. You know, you would have we had this 5 o'clock press conference every day with the military and the CPA, the Coalition Provisional Authority, spokesperson every day, where we would go to kind of figure out, and they would say things like, the helicopter sounds you hear over Baghdad are the sound of freedom. You know, that's a quote. by General Kimmett, the military spokesman there. And, you know, and it's just a lot of ideology and sort of not really being able to face the truth in the face and believe what they wanted to believe. But now I think even the administration has become more pragmatic. I think the whole dealing with the Sunni insurgency, the Sunni awakening, is just a sign of being pragmatic and thinking, well, you know, we're not winning if we just hang on to our ideology. We have to really see what the facts are on the ground.
Right. You got up first. You, your hand. Yes. You.
I know.
Can you point to a single event or series of events in the course of the Iraq war that has impacted you the most?
Me?
Either one of you.
Well, I mean, me personally?
Yeah.
Well, there's actually a... There's a bit on this in my book, and I think, you know, anybody who's been over there for a long time has had a lot of close calls. And I mean, if I just think of the bureau where I work, you know, we've been, you know, kidnapped, beaten, shot at, detained, killed, kidnapped, detained, chased. I mean, you know, I could go on and on. I had several of those myself, but I had one particularly awful experience where I was with a group of Marines, and you know, they're just, you know, a bunch of 19-year-olds from wherever, and in Fallujah in November 2004, if you remember, is this particularly horrendous battle. I think, you know, I was with a company of guys, 150 guys. At the end of a week, a quarter of them were dead or wounded. You know, it was really, really intense, and the battle, you know, we thought the battle was over, and a group of Marines were escorting me and a photographer to a minaret where there was a dead insurgent at the top, and the photographer I was with wanted to get a picture of it. And city was quiet, and so we were starting to go into the minaret, and a young man named Lance Corporal William Miller, who I never quite got to see, put his hand out and said, "I'm going to go up first. Just come in behind me." So we went up the stairs together, and there was a dead insurgent at the top, but there was also a live insurgent in the top, and he shot and killed Lance Corporal Miller, and basically, you know, blew his brains out all right there on the spot. And then he got stuck up there with the insurgents still there, and then some insurgents came in and surrounded us, and we almost didn't get out alive. But Yeah, you know, but he was shot for photographs. So, it's just something it's not something you forget, you know. You pick.
For me? I think the accumulated experience of being there, I think, as Dexter mentioned, I've been chased and shot at and kidnapping attempts. My mom's here. She's probably like thinking, you never told me that. But I think, watching, for me, the thing that was very difficult was what was happening to the people around me, to the Iraqis, to our staff. You know, I had a period where our Iraqi staff couldn't sleep in their home because it was the sectarian war had showed up and they'd gotten a death threat, and there was just this ongoing, every day there was something else. You know, my guard got a death threat, the next day the drivers couldn't go, the translator was almost assassinated, and then Iraqi friends were, and it was very disturbing because, you know, you just realize there's nothing you can do to stop what's happening. And when I left Iraq, finally, you know, for a long time, I felt very guilty and very sad and outraged. And it just stays with you that you can just pick up and leave, and these people are stuck there. And
how about you there in the middle? Yeah, I hate.
Okay, you've got the Sunnis and the Shiites, and there's contention there. Now, something has to be done. There has to be some remedy. Now, this involves military action. Okay. You want me to just run over it real quick? You've got Sunnis and Shiites. There's contention there. You need a remedy. It involves military action. And something has to be done. Something must be done. But this is way over in a different part of the world. We're in the Northern Hemisphere. The reason we are there is because Tel Aviv Israelis tell us, hey, we need a military force there. You got to go there. And so that's why we're there.
What's your question?
Well, this is all a bunch of stuff. Well, why are we there? Why? We don't even belong there. Why are we there? Why don't we just say, hey, this isn't, I mean, it just doesn't make any sense.
Well, I think the quick answer to that is it's a little late.
Yeah, we're already there.
we broke it. We bought it. You know. Yeah. How about you right there?
Yeah. This is sort of a what if. We went in with about 130,000 troops, and General Zinni had drawn up a plan with about 300,000 troops. And had we gone in with that kind of force and not disbanded the Iraqi army, would we have been any better off, or would we have stopped a lot of the looting, but would we have been able to calm the people and just by sheer numbers, or were we still going to have the resistance?
I think to some extent, you would still have the resistance because it wouldn't change the fact that a foreign army had invaded Iraq and had occupied it, regardless of the numbers. So you would still have people who were angry and resisting. But I do think that had there been better planning, had there been better policy and better securing of the borders, maybe the insurgency wouldn't get so out of hand. Maybe the civil war could have been contained.
Well, you know, I think you have to remember that one of the things that America did when it went there was it didn't just take down the government, it kind of made a revolution. And, you know, the Sunnis had been just a minority, I mean, 15-20% of the population. They'd been in charge there for 1,400 years, and more or less. And we empowered the majority there. And I think, you know, everywhere in the Arab world, the Sunnis represent power, you know, and you can tell when you're sitting with them, you know. That's the way they feel in Iraq, and that's what they know. And they weren't defeated when we got there, and they knew they weren't defeated, and I don't think they were going to go down without a fight. And so I don't think if we'd have kept a bunch of them on the payroll, I don't know. I mean, I think, frankly, the awakening that's happened was made possible in large part because they were facing the prospect of genocide, really, at the hands of the Shiite government. or Al-Qaeda at the rear. And I think they kind of looked both ways and said, we need to make a deal. And so they made a deal, you know. And so my own sense is, God, I just think that the tensions and these historical tensions were so enormous that they just never could have been managed. But, you know, what if?
Yes, go ahead. Two more? Okay.
One reads that most of the middle class and anybody who could afford it or manage it has gotten out. Mm-hmm. Were most of the middle class, or can you make a generalization, were they Sunnis?
Sunnis were definitely better off than Shias because they had more access to the education and, you know, government posts and the technocrat jobs. You know, for the longest time, you had to be a Ba'ath Party member to have any sort of a government post, even a teaching post. But they were also Shias. There was, you know, a thriving Shia middle class in Baghdad. But yes, the most people who could leave have left. There were about 2.5 million refugees, Iraqi refugees, in neighboring countries living in limbo. That's a lot of people, and 2.5, about 2 million internally displaced. That's 2.7 internally displaced. So that's, you know, 20% of the population.
And so if there's no middle class, who is going to rebuild?
Yes, that's what the Iraqis say too.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Should we pick? How about you in the front here?
Mr. Filkins, a couple of weeks ago in the New York Sunday Times magazine section, you had an article about the situation in Pakistan. I'm wondering if you see any kind of Pakistan developing into another fiasco like we have now in Iraq.
Oh, boy. Do I think we're going to invade?
No, not necessarily invade, but the maybe balkanization or... We have been flying drones over Pakistan, and now, according to what I've read, there's been American covert troops going in there.
Well, I mean, that's an incredibly complex kind of situation, and so, I'll boil it down to three sentences. I just wrote this story about Pakistan and kind of the tribal areas, which is the area right on the eastern border of Afghanistan. And, you know, the situation in Afghanistan has deteriorated, you know, markedly. And in large part because of these sanctuaries where the Taliban has been able not just to kind of reconstitute itself, but really it's its own force in Pakistan. And they're now so strong that they control not just the tribal areas, but large parts of western Afghanistan, and are now sort of, you know, setting their sights on other places in Pakistan. And but I think, you know, there's kind of, it's an unbelievably complicated and difficult situation. We have given the Pakistani government $10 billion in aid since 2001, and at the same time, I think it's basically beyond dispute, the same military that we've been aiding has been helping the Taliban. But it's not that simple just to kind of cut them off because, you know, Pakistan has a population of 175 million people. It's on the brink of chaos all the time, always has been. And I think, you know, if just in terms of America's interests, not only are they able to, the Taliban are able to send fighters into Afghanistan, pretty much at will, which was made pretty clear to me when I was there. But at the same time, you know, there's some division of opinion on this, but Bruce Hoffman, for example, who's a professor at Georgetown University, pointed out to me, for example, that there have been six terrorist attacks, major terrorist attacks or plots that have been either broken up or successful, including the 7/7 attacks in London that killed 52 people, have all been traced back to the tribal areas, and that Al-Qaeda's been able to kind of reconstitute itself, and that, you know, he has some great fear. A lot of people in American intelligence have some great fear that they're planning another attack. And so, God, what are we going to do? I don't know. I mean, you know. Why don't you just take one more?
We have time. We don't have time for any more questions if we want to have the book signing. I want to thank you both for your courage and your candor and these wonderful books. They'll meet you in the lobby for the book signing. Thank you both so much.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.